Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
Jimmy. Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. Do you want to get better at improv but feel stuck in a rut? Does it seem like everyone is having more fun than you? Well, stop worrying and start improving. Improv ABC, the A to Z guide to becoming an unstoppable improviser, is a fun, illustrated book by veteran improviser Ben Noble, loaded with tips and tricks that are so practical and useful, you can try them out in your show tonight. This book is for improvisers of all skill levels, delivering a straightforward approach to fundamentals that will improve your play and get you back to having fun on stage. Learn more at improvabc.com. That's improvabc.com. Buckhouse Theater in Chicago's North Center neighborhood has shows every weekend and opportunities for artists of all stripes. The schedule is packed with indie improv shows, kids shows, stand-ups, and even a classical Greek play here and there. Bughouse is proud to offer independent performers a stake in their own production. All of Bughouse independent partners and groups have an opportunity to split the earnings of their shows with the house. Interested in seeing a show, performing, or renting a rehearsal space? Then visit us at bughousetheater.com or email us at bughouse@bughousetheater.com. Yes, yes, yes. I know you're probably tired of me saying it, but I'm going to say it anyways. We have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you, and this is a special episode. It's a straight interview. We were lucky enough to get our guest today, Lance Barber. He's probably best known as Pauly G on HBO's The Comeback, which is one of my favorite shows. He has also appeared as a reoccurring character on It's Sunny in Philadelphia and MTV's Faking It. Lance is originally from Battle Creek, Michigan, but in the late 90s, he studied at Second City in the I.O. Chicago with the legendary improv guru Del Close. We talked to him about turning down a job at the Second City Touring Company to move to Los Angeles, what he learned from Del Close, and HBO bringing back The Comeback after 10 years. Their second season happened 10 years after their first, and what that was like for him. But before we get to that episode, I just want to say I have been doing some stand-up. I did some stand-up last night, and I got to tell you this. I feel really old, and as I was walking to the bar, it was an open mic night, I just felt, you know, like sad. And I went up, and it was okay, but I just feel like, you know, all these young kids, like they're in their 20s and stuff like that, and like I'm 51, and I'm like, what am I doing? What am I doing this? Like, part of me is regret. Like, I wish when I started out in my 20s, I would have done stand-up. But I think I've talked about this before. I know I have in interviews. When I started out in improv, nobody did stand-up. And actually, stand-up was looked down upon. And I remember doing a couple shows after a couple improv shows and going and doing stand-up and bringing my improv team at the time and them watching me and saying, you're great. You're a natural at this. And I was so angry at them. I'm like, you know, fuck you guys. I want to do improv. I'm not selling out. And you know what? I wish I had sold out earlier. Here it is. You're going to love this, the Lance Barber episode. This is a straight-on interview. We do not improvise here. I know you're going to enjoy it. I just love his character, Pauly G, on The Comeback, and I love that show. So I'm so glad that when he came into town, we had an opportunity to interview him. Here it is, the Lance Barber episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
All right. Lance, you grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and you come from a family that you said was wonderfully high in emotion. Can you tell us about that?
What a thing to start with, Jimmy.
Yeah.
My family will be really appreciative to hear me talk about that, I'm sure. I mean, it's a classic. We were a classic Midwest family. It was a blue-collar family that I came up in. I grew up in Battle Creek, which is a factory town.
Well, the Kellogg's, right?
Of course, yeah, the cereal city of the United States of America. Both my grandparents retired off the line at Kellogg's. Mm. They working in the boxes and the bagging and the cornflakes. You could smell them in the, you know, in the air. I was just there, and you could smell the cereal still. There's still factories in operation. And we were a classic Midwest family. High to emotion means there was means exactly that. We were just
a lot of. Were you a yelling family?
There was some yelling. That's where it would get to. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a yelling family, but not. But such a less of the European Eastern East Coast kind of, you know, classic style that that we know about, mm-hmm. The passionate yelling family.
What nationality were you guys?
We were very white. Very
okay.
American. Yeah. Very. Very middle European, mm-hmm. descent, and been in this country for a very long time. So. Mm-hmm. But French, Dutch, German, all mm-hmm. that. My grandmother was Pennsylvania Dutch, and, mm-hmm. or Dutch rather, German blood, and came from Ohio. So very, very American, very Midwest for a long time. But also at the same time, a very, my grandfather had six children, and my grandmother, they had six children. It was a very loving, open family, but still very small town and blue collar. And
what were you like as a kid?
I had a mother who was a black sheep of that family.
They okay.
Were, my family is fairly conservative, mm-hmm. Republican, mm-hmm. and my mother was the liberal black sheep of the family, and maybe the troublemaker a bit. And I was raised under that roof. My grandparents also helped raise me. My father died when I was a year old. He was killed when he was in the army through an accident, mm-hmm. and So he was not around. He's not someone that I remember. So I was raised by my grandparents. They helped out my mother, mm-hmm. who needed it very much so. And so every weekend of my life, I spent with my grandparents, and plus. So they were a big influence, but on the other side, so I had that influence. I went to church every Sunday, a Lutheran church. I grew up in a church. And then there was my mom, who was the black sheep, who was on the back of Harleys with her old men. And there was, you know, more liberal environment around me as a young child. So I had kind of a broad spectrum of experience.
When did you start to get into comedy?
It always appealed to me because I was, in the most classic sense, like so many of us, a fat kid with no dad and had trouble making friends, and so that was my way. It took me a while because I was somewhat introverted. I was a slow burn. Socially, you know, I would warm up, but it would take me a while. So I'm still that way. People are surprised to know, but it takes me a minute to warm up in a social situation.
Almost socially awkward, a little.
No, I wouldn't say that. I don't think that I'm on the spectrum. I would go classically shy. I'd be happy to admit that if I was, but I don't think that it was that case. But I was a shy kid, for sure. I think it was more my experience growing up as opposed to my biological predisposition. So, at least I. Who knows? Who knows? Am I right, Jimmy?
You're totally right. We don't know.
Nurture nature. It's all.
Yeah,
yeah. So, I forget what the
original comedy. When did you start to get into comedy?
I mean, just like HBO came on TV when you were a kid. Now, I watched Carol Burnett's show with my grandparents, and it always appealed to me. Those are the things they want to watch. We watched SNL every Saturday night. I watched Johnny Carson with my mom, who would let me stay up to watch Johnny Carson with her. So, I was introduced to it. And I knew the power that it had pretty early on, especially for a shy kid. I wanted to do that. I wanted to make, and I was not the class clown. The class clown in my school was a kid named Ron Roach. And
where's Ron today?
He went to prison and okay. He's back out of prison. And he was, but he was a terrifically smart and funny guy. And he was naturally that guy. I was not naturally that guy. I wanted to be that guy, and I worked on it for a long time. It wasn't until high school that I got into theater, and I kind of opened up and blossomed and found that.
Do you remember the first time that you opened up and blossomed? Like the first show you did that you were like, oh my God, this is what I've wanted to do?
I remember when I opened up and blossomed as socially was at church. I went to a Lutheran church, and at school I was a quiet nerd. And at church, I could create a different persona.
And what was your church persona?
It was the funny guy. Now, that's where I got to be the class clown. Now, Sunday school.
Right. So yeah. So people are thinking, like, church would be a tough place to blossom. But what kind of stuff did you do to be the funny guy at church?
I mean, anything disruptive, anything that was comical, any question. Also to challenge the
authority.
That lovely pastor who was a very sweet man, but teaching us some wonderful things about Christ in the Bible, and I had questions about dinosaurs and things like that. That I would, you know, where are the dinosaurs in the Bible? All that stuff, and I would disrupt in any way with some sort of physical comedy because I was already by then a Jerry Lewis fan, and anything to make the other kids in Sunday school.
What was it about Jerry Lewis? Because a lot of people in our generation wouldn't cop to Jerry Lewis. There's kind of a stigma about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what was it about you that you liked Jerry Lewis so much?
It was the face. It was the clown. He could show so much physically. He was a terrific actor. It was broad. It was enormously broad. But he really convinced you of what he was feeling without saying too many words. He did it completely in a movie, you know, silently in The Bellboy. And I love that face. I loved a goofy face. You know, the stuff I do that I've done more recently as an actor certainly is more subdued and inward. But I think on a show that I did called The Comeback, I didn't speak much at all, and I had to show a lot of emotion and show create that character through my face. And I had that. I think I got that from watching Jerry Lewis films. You know, it's not quite the same thing, but it was the. The idea is the same.
How do you do that as an actor?
Well, I come by it, honestly, to your first question, by my mother, who raised me as a single mother, obviously from her situation with my dad passing away, and her and I are very close and tightly bonded. So I'd hate to throw her under the truck here, but my father called her Poker Face, and he did that, as a joke, because if she's feeling an emotion, especially a strong negative emotion, you know it. There's absolutely no way she can control the look on her face, the scowl, sort of the downturned mouth. It's beyond her to be able to control that, to hide that. She's not a very good actor. And I, on a lesser level, am prone to that as well. My wife will accuse me of such, for sure. She says, you're getting, there's your poker face, there's your mom face. You are upset.
There's a little of that in Pauly G, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No. And that's how he conveyed. I mean, it was all with... at the time doing it, I felt insecure doing that show. I thought I was throwing faces the whole time, and it wasn't substantive. So
really? On the first season or the second season?
The first season when I was doing it. Because they kept cutting lines. And they kept saying, no, it's working. Without the lines, better. Without the lines. I'm like, but he's saying real... He said, no, it's cartoonish when he's like verbally a dick to her. It's really working with just the faces you're throwing. It's just the glares. And I came around to realize that I agree with that. I think it worked well. And fans of the show think so, too. So I felt good about it eventually.
How do you deal with it? Because I am totally insecure, especially when you're on a set.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do you get over that? It's like, oh, we're going to cut your lines. It's going to be better. Trust us. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you know, any actor who says, I mean, the two worst things you can say to an actor, I think, is, stop overacting, and we're cutting your lines.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, a little nausea.
Okay.
And then I carry on. I try to, as a considered effort, to not let that bother me, to move forward as opposed to sit in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not one to sit in anything too long compared to how I was raised, perhaps. I don't linger. I try not to linger. And that's also been something that I've tried to accomplish. I try not to linger in things. So I had to that first time. I also, on the flip side of that, feel somewhat confident in the choices that I make, regardless of all of the cooks in the kitchen who are giving their input. So I feel like if you start there and you can take the note and do what they say and please your boss, and I feel like I'm doing that, at least, then I can go away and feel okay about it until I see it on the screen, at least.
Are you comfortable seeing yourself on the screen?
I am. I think more so than most people. I cringe, deeply cringe at some of the things that I see me do, or some of the takes that I think, how could you use that take? That's I'm positive I have something better. I'm certain of it. So it's not. There's plenty of cringeworthy moments. But I like it. I do learn from it, I think. And I'm immature, I guess. I still get a kick out of seeing myself on TV. It's what I wanted to do when I was a kid, like so many of us. And I see myself up there, and I'm tickled about it. You know?
And then, so you do theater, and you come to, when you come after college.
Yeah, I didn't do much college. I went to Kellogg Community College, locally, a community college. And I did the theater program there and got my associate's degree and was going to continue a Western Michigan run, but your friends were going.
But you'd also done summer stock, too, at Barn Theater.
But I started working professionally. I did like a, remember the murder mystery improv shows?
Yeah.
I was doing those during the school year, and in the summer I was doing summer stock theater. And I was getting a better education, I thought, than I would have at college.
And you were getting paid.
And I was getting paid, yeah.
So then after college, after you do summer stock, you decide to move to Chicago to study at Second City in I.O.
Mm-hmm.
And you were really, at this point, more interested in theater, right?
I came to do, it was a compromise, Chicago was. I was dating a girl. We were moving here together.
Okay.
And she and I wanted to go to a big city. I was an actor. I thought, let's give L.A. a shot. She was wanted to be a model. She said, let's go to New York. And I said, well, it's a big city for small-town kids. Let's start in the Midwest and just move from there. So we compromised on Chicago and had friends here already. Somebody I grew up with, a Michigan second city person named Holly Walker, who's now on she's now on TV. The Larry Wilmore took over Daily Show. She's working in New York on that. Anyway, she was in New York, in Chicago already. And we came to look for an apartment. We stayed with Holly, and she said, you have to see the show called Pinata Full of Bees. And we said, okay, of course.
You saw Pinata. What was your reaction?
I said, I got to do that. I got to try that. I definitely was coming to Chicago to pursue more of the theater and be an actor. And I saw that, and I did no theater besides improv and sketch the entire 5 years I was in Chicago because of that show.
And, but you also were known as I remember, you would play around. You had a guitar, and you would play funny music, original stuff, not parody stuff.
No, it was comedy music, which most people in the stand-up world can't stand the guy with the guitar that they have to
Did you get a lot of shit from that when you were doing
that? A little bit, but I had a good community that I was in when I was doing it here and in Los Angeles. So they were, it was buddies, so they were supportive. I've had play shows out, though. Most of the other comics don't like the guitar comic. But it was super blue. And I was with my best friend who I grew up with, who's still a fantastic musician. He's been working at the Summer Stock, now as an equity house actor, where we both started back in
at the Barn Theater?
Michigan, at the Barn Theater in Augusta, Michigan. I was just there a few nights ago seeing him in a production of Hands on a Hard Body, the musical.
What is that like, you going back there? Like, you've made it. You know, like, what is it
to
like?
To some degree, yeah. Most of those kids don't know who I am, but
really?
Some of them do. Yeah, yeah.
Do you ever be like, oh, you don't, do you ever get into like, oh, don't you know me kind of thing?
I mean, I look around for people to see if they're looking at me. Sure, sure. When I was growing up, I went to that theater, the Summer Stock Theater. It was in an old barn, and it was the celebrity that was there as an apprentice, like I did, and then went on to fame was Tom Wolpat.
From Dukes of Hazzard.
He's there again this year, but he was the one that would come back and do a show every summer, and the women would go gaga, right? And so he was. I'm still not a Tom Wolpat when I go back there. I haven't reached that status.
Have they reached out and said, "Hey, will you come back next summer?"
They ask me every year.
Are you serious? Show.
Yeah, and I would love to if I could afford to be out of L.A. and mostly it's family stuff in the summertime that is so busy that keeps me from doing that. But I would kill. But that's a 4-week commitment of 2-week rehearsal, 2-week show. And as much as I'd like to do it, I just can't yet, but I think that I will.
What did you learn when you were there? Because that is such an intense schedule. Like, you're learning, you're putting up a show in 2 weeks, and then you're rehearsing it the next show, right?
Right.
For the that'll be up
so the following. Rehearsing the day for the next show. So, yeah, it's 2 weeks of performance and 2 weeks of rehearsal. So it's constant. You're constantly you're learning a new show while you're performing the other show. And it's an insane schedule, even for the equity actors who don't. Who aren't mowing the lawns and cleaning toilets and building the set.
You had to do that, all that too?
As an apprentice, you got paid like $70 a week, too, and you built the set, you did the box office, the refreshment stand, you mowed the lawn in this enormous acreage where they parked the cars, and that's mostly what I did. And it worked your ass off all day, went into your rehearsals when it was time for you to do your number, and went back out to work and kept the grounds of that place. That's how they run those places. And then in the evening, you'd do a show and two shows on the weekend, and you slept very little, but you were also 18, 19, 20 years old. And my friend who's out there, who I said I did it with, we both grew up in Battle Creek, grew up going to that theater and ended up working there. He's back doing it again as a 40-something-year-old man, and it's destroying him. Yeah.
I hope he doesn't have to mow the lawn.
He doesn't.
Or park cars.
He does volunteer to do so sometimes, but he's equity now. He only has to fulfill his equity.
What did that prepare you, that kind of schedule?
What it taught me was the workings of a theater in a broad sense, because you got to do everything, even building set costumes, box office, all that. And it was young people wanting to do the same thing, so the camaraderie was magical of the people being there in this world that they were just starting in with a strong passion for it. And I learned I learned more there, like I said, than I think I would have in college because it was experiential.
And why is it, you know, a lot of people who start out, they're like, I just want to act. I just want to act. I don't want to do the box office. I don't want to do lights. I don't want to do stage crew. Why is it important for an actor to know all of the aspects of a theater?
I think that that's your world that you're living in. I think anything that you do professionally, you should know. If you consider yourself a professional, you should have some sort of a perspective on the workings and appreciation for people doing those things that are helping you make this happen, especially when you're a talent and you're going to be on stage. If it weren't for them helping you get the people in and making the sets and yada yada, then you would you'd be an instant diva. I guess that exists. You don't have to appreciate that, and you can still be successful. I think you're just a better human if you do.
I agree with you, and I think a lot of times you can tell the people that, you know, like they don't when you're on a set, they don't appreciate what the gaffer does and whatever, and they treat people like dirt because they've never been in that job.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and there's a hierarchy for sure, and certainly, like you said, even in Hollywood and film and television, there certainly is. Yet everyone must realize that they couldn't do it without those people, that it's not just, you'd be doing a one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you didn't have all those people, you'd be doing a one-man show in a black box stage where you're taking the tickets at the door before. You know, that's the alternative to not having those people being passionate about this art in some aspect.
Mm-hmm. And now we get you come to Chicago and you work at the Second City box office.
Yeah.
And Kelly Leonard said you would do a lot. Kelly Leonard, was the producer, did a lot of crazy stuff. He said one time he stopped by the box office and you had your shirt off and the lights off and you were dancing to Marvin Gaye.
Now, if I could remember that,
okay,
I would tell you about it.
Okay.
But I believe that it's true.
Okay. Because I see you today, and you don't seem like you would do something like that.
Yeah, but that was 20 years ago.
Okay.
Jimmy. That was, okay. We were young people. I was probably on drugs, and I was very horny. And
okay.
And like many of us, I was spreading my wings in this. It was just post-college, still college age.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of my college experience, was doing Second City Conservatory and working in the box office and finding this community of people that I jived with. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, you have your best friends at home that you have a secret language with, and you think, I'm so above everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
We have this kind of this connection, and I get into this community at Second City, this improv sketch community where everybody's like that, and it was pretty magical for sure. And so, yeah, that was partying was certainly a part of that part of my life for sure.
You also studied at I.O. with Del Close.
Yes, I did.
What was that experience like?
Del bummed a few cigarettes for me when I was a smoker back there. I think we all remember that. What a wise man. And I actually had a nice experience with Del, although I think that it was a comical experience with Del. He was it was not long before he died, and he was a complex fellow,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, yes.
And I have one memory of... Just a note that he gave me that was so basic, but it stuck with me. I did a scene with a kid named Matt Cullison, who I came up with here. And we stepped out on stage, and Matt did, he established a wonderful scene with, we were two firemen, and we just got a call. And he was sluggishly getting ready. And I made the choice to, what are you doing? We got to hurry. And Del stopped us, and he said, you just received a gift. And that was when I learned about the gift, to follow. And I guess it could have gone either way, but the smart choice was to follow this thing that he established, and it was. You're both sluggish. That's the game. You don't care about this fire. And then we went on to do this very funny, brilliant scene based on a very rudimentary note for improv, but it was something that stuck with me forever.
Basically, he was telling you, there's the gift, mirror your partner.
Absolutely.
So you have your sights on Second City, right? At
yeah.
this point, you want to get into Second City.
Yeah, like everybody that comes out here and seeing like that show. I set up I got into the box office because I wanted to be around and be liked by the people that mattered and work with friends who were already here doing the same thing and did shows in the Donny Skybox Theater and that's when I started doing the guitar stuff. The comedy songs just as an opportunity to show myself and yes get into Second City, to have that on my resume and to have that experience. I wanted to at least do the touring company.
And they offer you the touring company.
I've been in the short list, like so many of us have been in the short list for a long time. 3 years, maybe. I don't know.
And that, which meant you had auditioned, and then...
You didn't get it, but you're...
They've got you on the list.
They got you on the list. Right. We like you. And that lingered and lingered. And then I started doing other things, like this stand-up. And I started having casting directors notice me because I was doing enough commercials to get into the union, to get into AFTRA at the time. And I started kind of... was starting to work, and other people were noticing me. And then I felt like when Second City said, oh, we didn't see it ourselves, but other people see it. Maybe we'll hire you. And it was just an opportunity to, I think Jason Sudeikis or somebody was going somewhere, and they had an opening. And I was offered a spot. I did one home show. I filled in for Brian Boland or someone, and did a Monday night show, Best of Second City, one show, and that was my one show on the main stage at Second City as an understudy. And after that, I was offered to go, I think, on Bluco or something. And I thought about it for a day. I asked Kelly to give me a day because I already made plans to make go to Los Angeles. And I, after all that want and hope for those years, sadly and proudly declined the offer. Yeah.
What was the sad part of it and what was the proud part of it?
It was just a whole, like, a growing up thing, that sad part of growing up, of learning that Santa Claus and then not going trick-or-treating anymore, you know? It was something that you held dearly for so long, and you realize that you're maybe beyond it now. As much as you wanted it at the time, it was time to make another step that was forward as opposed to remain where you are. And so it was bittersweet. And it also felt like a little bit of a fuck you. I've been around for 3 years. You had your chance. I'm taking this shot somewhere else, yeah.
You know, because it's interesting, at that time when we go back, because we were around the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody turned down Second City because your mentality was, okay, I get in the touring company, I wait it out for a couple of years, I get on main stage, and I'm going to be set, especially, you know, back then. Now it's much more common. People do it all the time.
Yeah. But I was 27, you know, and I'd been there throughout my early mid-20s, and it was, and I felt like it was time to make a leap if I was going to, because I was still a young man and had the energy and the desire to maybe take the clobbering that I might receive making that kind of move.
So you moved to L.A. in 2000, mm-hmm. and how hard was it at the beginning when you get out there at 27 years old?
Easier than I anticipated. Part of that was because of coming up in Chicago like I had the last year I was here. I had auditioned for some television that was here, and I'd been flown out to do a test. And I tested with a show that Steve Martin was a producer on and got to test in a room with Steve Martin. And I was getting pretty big britches, you know. There was a Chicago Comedy Festival, and I was playing my Filthy, Dirty, Funny songs for that festival. And a guy named Joel Zadak came out. And he had just moved. He was a Chicago kid who had moved out to L.A. to be a writer, and he became a manager at a management company. And he was scouting, and he saw my act and said, "You coming to L.A.?" And I said, "Yeah." And you know, 6-7 months, I am. He says, "I'll represent you when you do." And I said, "Even more reason to go." You know, and that hurdle. If I'd gone to L.A. without accomplishing that first, I think it would have been enormously difficult. But the fact that I had a representation that was getting me into rooms immediately when I got to that town was enormous. It was huge. People that have to jump that hurdle and get representation once they move to the city and struggle that way, I think is a different thing than I got to, that I was lucky enough to get. Yeah.
And then in 2015, now you've done guest spots up to about 2015 when you get the comeback, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the first comeback was 2005,
I think.
Five, yes. And so I did that show, and then I continued to work as... I never worked in a series regular again. I had some recurring and guest spots, all from the comeback.
Mm-hmm.
And tested for shows, this and that. But nothing that ever... I had nothing that I had hoped the comeback would garner.
Mm-hmm.
I had hoped that it would get me onto the next thing because I got some attention for a show that was short-lived but got attention, and that never came. I when after I did the first season of The Comeback, I fired my I fired my
manager. Agent?
No. It was
publicist.
It was the
Pilates instructor.
My Pilates instructor.
Okay.
And and my commercial agent. And I told them, "Beat it! I'm ready to skyrocket from this HBO show that I'm on." And I didn't. And then I had a kid a few years later, and I was on the phone to my manager saying, "Can you get me a commercial agent again? I could use a little."
You didn't go back to the same one, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, great. So in 2005, when Comeback comes out,
yeah.
you think this is just gonna, this is it?
Yeah, I mean, it was the attention that it got, and she was up for an Emmy. The show was up for an Emmy. It got me into it. Opened up so many doors for me. It was the first time I was seen in anything, and the character was memorable enough. As small as it was memorable enough to have people invite me into rooms that I wouldn't have got into before, go right to producers for stuff, and meet a lot of new people, and offer jobs. I was offered a job on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and that's been great because I worked on that show for a lot of years now as a recurring character, and that was because of that show. They just offered me that role.
You didn't even have to audition for it. The show, you know, The Comeback is so brilliant. And I have to confess, I didn't see the first season until I think it was like last year. I'm on a plane. I'm going flying to Oakland to teach. And I'm like, oh, I got to watch. And I was blown away by this show.
Yeah.
I was just blown away, especially you and Lisa Kudrow. It was really great. And I thought to myself, why don't you think it's become a bigger mainstream hit?
Because I think it's still a very selective audience. People that don't watch it is middle America who don't care about Hollywood, first of all. People in Hollywood who are vapid and annoying. They really don't. And then people that don't get it. And I understand that. There's so many people that love the American Office that hated the British Office or wouldn't watch it. You know?
Oh, I love the British Office.
I do too. And that's what turned me on about The Comeback. I said to Lisa, when the first day of work, she was smoking cigarettes, and so was I, and we had a cigarette on the dock at Warner Brothers together before anybody else arrived. And I said, this has a very British Office feel. And she said, shh. And I knew then that this was going to be something that I really wanted to be involved with, right? So I think that's that it's a selective audience. I think it's people don't, obviously, as much as it's out there now and more mainstream, the uncomfortable stuff is still excludes a lot of people.
She also has a Groundlings background. So yeah. She comes from an improv background. Is there any improvisation going on the set?
Very little. It's tightly scripted to sound improvised. She's a good improviser, and we both improvised a little bit on both series, on both both seasons of the series, and mostly her. She's the one that. But honestly, it's very tightly scripted. They allowed it. Michael Patrick King allowed a little play, but the schedules were so tight, and they were so sure about what they wanted and where they were going, that they had it all tightly scripted.
You know, you say that it was they set it up so it feel improvised. Mm-hmm. How do you accomplish that as an actor?
I think that the characters are so kind of broad, and they're written to be, I wouldn't say broad, that's the wrong word, but they're extreme characters. Hers certainly is, and I guess hers is a little broad, but it's believable, so just everything has to be natural, I think, to ground everything and make it natural, and give a natural performance to some things that are pretty absurd, even, you know, and I think that gives it that tone. Sure.
You know, you compare it to the British Office, and both characters, you know, Stuart Brent on The Office, yeah, and Lisa's character, there is such a sadness to their characters.
Yes.
And I wish, what is it about sadness that people don't tap into it? Because I find that just to be comedy gold.
Absolutely. I agree. I always found that the negative emotions were the most funny. Sadness is hysterical because it has pathos. You can find a reason to care about that person. As well as anger, I've always thought was very funny if it done well.
Why are people afraid to play that in improv?
I don't know. You think people are afraid to play that stuff in?
Yeah. Anger, like people just, they will not go there.
I think it's because it's a highly sensitive issue. Maybe even a personal thing for so many people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something we avoid in our daily life, that's for sure. So I think maybe we avoid it on stage as well.
Another thing improvisers afraid to play is a jerk. And Paulie G is like such a jerk on this show.
I don't know why that. Okay. That's one of the most fun things to do. Everyone knows that the villain is the one is the fun.
Why do you love playing jerks? Because you're not a jerk in real life.
As far as you know, Jim. You're we don't know each other that well. Okay. So I could... My wife might disagree, but
she's going to be on next week, and she'll be able to respond.
To it all out. Great. Like I said, it's the old adage that you always want to play the villain, you know, and you get to do you get to say things that you want to say but don't because you're a decent or kind or thoughtful human being, and so you get to enjoy playing that. I don't know how to put it into words that it's fun. I think anybody would have fun playing the jerk, you know. Just for that reason, it's something you don't get to do, and people that and it's safe. It's a safe place to do that, and maybe vent a little bit of the stuff that you don't want to show about yourself, the darker side. So,
do you think you're in Paulie G? How much is Lance Barber?
I mean, there's a hint of him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hint of Lance Barber in there. Those, like I said, those some of those glares and things that people have seen naturally from me, I'm sure. When I'm angry, that's my poker face that I got from my mother. The scowls, and I think it's the way my face is built. I have dark circles under my eyes, and I don't know. I think it's there's a physicality to me, and I'm a kind of big guy. I'm heavy set, and makes people dislike me a little more. And to be as indifferent at the same time as being aggressive.
Did I read something where you said something like you almost have an angry face or something like that?
I mean, I think I have an easy scowl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think I have that is intimidating to some degree, and I think that natural physicality that I have was helpful for the role for sure.
And Lisa Kudrow said that she can see all your thoughts come across your face, and she thinks that's because of your improv training. How do you think your improv training has affected your acting?
I mean, enormously. At risk of being cliche, I've learned to listen through my improv training. I was one when I was doing theater as a young person, and I was making so many choices off the script. And when we get to the show, I remained in those choices. I was kind of tight and technical. I had ideas about, and then I would take the direction, of course, from a director, but I was listening for their line to end as opposed to listening to the person. The other actor.
How do you do that? Because I still struggle with that.
I still struggle with it too, but it's kind of that Zen state when you get into that, when you're in it, you know, when you are, when you let go. I can't think of anything that's not cheesy to say about it, but.
Is it easier for you, like, okay, I'm going to be in Paulie G, that I'm going to be in that character.
Yeah.
And then I can respond to Paulie G versus if it's just Lance.
No, absolutely. I think that I don't need people to not talk to me when I come to set. It's not that. But it is, the guy that played Mickey had some wonderful words to say about it, and I can't quote him because I don't remember what they are, but the idea of it depends on the other actor. And so, certainly in the show like The Comeback, everybody that you worked with, especially Lisa, everything I was getting from her made it easy to be there. It was obvious. It was easy to react to that.
Why?
Because the character she was playing was really annoying. Okay, genuinely. And even though that she was a sympathetic character in the end, that is a horrible person to be around. I mean, let's be honest. And I was always just a little sympathetic to Paulie G. It was funny because I think in the first show, it was people thought that a lot of women sided with her. They found her a sympathetic character eventually as annoying as she was. And a lot of men sided with Paulie G. They're like, I can't watch the show. I don't think she's funny. I think she's just genuinely aggravating, that neurotic personality. And so it's not that hard, and she is so good at it. That character is so incredible. She is so phenomenal, and she is so in it and so dedicated to it. That's the Groundlings character that she adapted to the show. It's something that she's been doing for a long time. That is in her wheelhouse.
Oh, she had been doing that character?
That character is based on a Groundlings character.
Okay.
There was a looser version and a younger version of that, and that's where Valerie. So she's had that in her, you know, that character. She's just so phenomenally good at that character, and it was easy to respond to that character as not only as Paulie G, but as Lance Barber for sure.
You know, the other thing about the show is it is so I just love how it skews Hollywood. And do you find that there's a lot of truth to the show?
Yeah, I mean, it's satire. Mm-hmm. It lampoons the business, but I think that was why everybody that's out there and why it got me so much attention, because everybody in the business watched it because it was so right on. It wasn't broad satire. It was, those people exist, those kind of shows exist. I've never worked with Pauly G, but I know that he's out there. I think I've met him in an audition room a time or two.
You know? Have you had like rough experiences like on the show?
Luckily, no.
Okay. Why do you think that is?
Because I don't work that much.
Okay. There's the secret, people.
There's the secret. Keep it minimal. Minimal. I'm good at, I don't know, I'm fairly affable, and I'm good at avoiding and keeping my distance from anybody that...
So if you see...
I'm not confrontational. I meet those people. I'm not interested in challenging them at all.
So, because I know I've worked on sets where there's not jobs. I'm sure you have, too. You just avoid them, right?
I do. And I also think, like I said, my physicality makes me intimidating, so they don't approach me as much as they would other people.
Right. I'm just...
Or treat me the same way, perhaps.
I'm just sucked into it.
Yeah.
I love the drama.
Yeah.
You know, so the comeback's on for one season, in 2005, and you're disappointed at the reaction, right?
I'm thrilled at the personal gain it's got me by getting me into rooms and stuff. But
right.
I'm disappointed it didn't go on, obviously. Everyone was kind of crushed. It was promised to Michael Patrick King from the head at the time of HBO that it would be continuing, and then it was pulled out from
And then in 2004, they bring it back on the air. Were you surprised that it got a second life?
Well, I was shocked, yeah.
Do you remember when you got the phone call?
I do, but it was like this trickle, you know? It wasn't the, hey, it's coming back.
Right.
It had been, you know, for years even, immediately following, and you know, throughout the nearly decade that followed the first season, there was hints and whispers about it coming back in some form. Netflix maybe will pick it up, or maybe HBO is going to do a one-off movie somehow, or, you know... There was all these little things that it might happen because people loved it, and it was slowly gaining this underground cult status, and more people were watching it 5-10 years later. And but after a few years of hearing all these whispers, that you give up on that because you figure, oh, it's not happening. And now it's been 8-9 years.
Right.
It's unheard of. It's not going to happen. It doesn't happen. And so that made it an event when it actually did. That was a cool thing too. That I don't know what television show has been brought back after nearly a decade, based on slow viewership.
What was it like the first day on the set after, you know, you guys hadn't worked together in 9 years? And not only that, Paul is getting a huge part. He's been, you know, he's...
I had the call I got was we think it's happening. There's all these other ducks that need to get in a row, but if they do, then it's happening. And the ducks came in a row. I got the call to go to Michael Patrick King's office on the Warner Brothers lot, and then it was official. I went in, and he sat down and told me the arc of the season, where it was going, and how the Pauly G character would be as necessary for her antagonist as he was initially, but there was his own whole story this time that wasn't there before, and how integral it was to the show. And I was very intimidated by that.
What were you intimidated by, of the stuff that they were asking the character to do?
I just wanted it to be good. Everybody did. There was really high stakes. 10 years had gone by. We're going to come back with this show that had been off the air for 10 years and garnered this community of the fans of the show are fanatic fans. I mean, they're genuine, crazy people, and which is thrilling. But we didn't want to disappoint them, and kind of the status it had gained by being a highly thought-of show that only did one season. If we come back and revisit that after it had garnered that status, it's got to be as good or better. And it's a big gamble. You could come back 10 years later and the show was and then your career is over. So for all of them, and they were less worried about that. Their career was over because they're both very successful people and have other projects. This is their baby, though. This was their pet project, so it was very high stakes for them. Lisa and Michael Patrick King.
They wrote it together, right?
They wrote it together. He's on Two Broke Girls. He's a
right. He doesn't
billionaire.
Right.
And Lisa certainly is probably still getting some checks from friends.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
So still works in, you know, other shows, other capacities. She's fine. But this meant a lot to them for all those reasons as well. So there was nervousness and anxiousness about the success of the show, and from all of us. And in the end, doing it, everybody felt confident. Seth Rogen came on, the scripts were great, everything was kind of falling into place, and then the reception of it solidified the notion that they had done it as good, if not better, than the first season.
Did you feel it was better than the first season?
I felt it was more fleshed out, yeah. I think it was a little better than the first season. I think it was at least as good, yeah.
And do we know if there's going to be another season? You can't tell me?
Well, no, I can tell you that they're asked that question. I've done a couple panels with them, and of course that's what people want to know, and they don't know. HBO has open arms. The reason it came back is because there was a changing of guard at HBO, and they were fans of the show, and it came up, you want to come back and try it? And I think they thought about it for quite a while, and they decided to and did, and it was a success, and HBO continues to leave the door open for them to do another season, if and whenever they want.
So what happened for you after this season? Because Pauly G has got he's a huge arc. He's had a lot of stuff. You know, he kicked the heroin habit. You know, and he's got his own project she's involved in. What kind of attention did you get the second time around?
Well, it's been fairly new, but just the accolades when I go into any room. When I go into an audition, it's almost always mentioned, you know. People in the business love that show because of the way it lampooned the business. And I get a lot of attention, if not just for congratulations for it. It hasn't garnered any particular work, you know, but I get into rooms that I hadn't before, and I'd still love to, you know, take some more from it.
Was it helpful that in 2005 you're like, okay, I didn't get the stuff. I had these expectations when it came out, and now 2014, I'm a little. I get how it works here.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And now I've done this show that I'd come to a place where I was satisfied with what it was based on the quality of it, as opposed to it making me money. And
because you don't make that much money on an HBO show.
No, you don't. No, okay. It's twice the quality of network TV and half the money. That's the adage, I think. And that's true. It's garbage money, but you have the prestige. So I am thrilled and more than satisfied with that prestige, especially after the second season came out. I did a show on HBO, which, you know, is a coveted place for actors to be working at, and it has this funny history in television of the show that came back after a decade, and it is a memorable character, and I honestly couldn't ask for more. Wherever it goes from that after the second season is gravy, because it is a bit of a dream come true. For sure.
How do you like stay this even? Is it how you were raised in the Lutheran church, like that? Like, I would have so many expectations. I'd be like, you know what, Pauly G should have his own show, you know?
As much as I'd like to, I'm not going to give the Lutheran church any credit for it.
Okay.
Perhaps there's some there, but I was a nerd kid who didn't do sports and loved it. Was seeing, you know, Grease in my bedroom, you know, that's who I was, and I wanted to do this always. It was classic story for so many of us in show business. Mm-hmm. It's what we've always kind of had this kid-like desire to do. And I've gotten to do, I've worked with people that I've admired. I've worked with a number of people that I grew up, you know, like Chevy Chase and Tim Conway and people that I grew up watching on TV and wanting to be them, you know, to some degree, be as funny as.
Was it when you meet them? What is that like?
Christopher Guest. I mean, these people that were all these kind of like childhood dreams come true. So I have stories. I have those stories now, and that's what I wanted from this career. And I have a family now and other interests. So the stakes I have for success in show business are much less because I have because that's not my life anymore. That's not 100% my life anymore, which it was as a young single man. Mm-hmm. There's other things that I find as and more important than my career in show business now. So that helps me not get too bunged up about it. And I feel like I've established a career that, as long as I stay in it and give it the right amount of attention, that I will continue to be a working actor, which was my goal. I wanted to not wait tables and do construction. I wanted to be a working actor, whatever that meant. I wanted to not do other things. I wanted to make a living. And I've made a living to, although there's been lean times, aplenty, Jimmy, I have made a living at it for 15 years and enough for me and my family, you know, to have a nice life. So my dreams have come true. I don't need any more. I never had any notion of fame because I didn't think it was, I would acquire it, and it wasn't that interesting to me. I wanted to be a blue-collar actor. I wanted to be a working actor. That's more romantic and more appealing to me, for sure.
What is it about the fame thing? Because you, in L.A., I mean, you can't not get caught up in the fame, you know?
I have enough.
Right.
I go to the ball game here I go see the Cubs play
today. Yeah, Wrigley Field.
Last time I went, I get shout-outs over the crowd. Pauly G! I get that stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not Brad Pitt. I can't not leave the house. Mm-hmm. But I get shout-outs. I get people approaching me that want to shake my hand or give me an autograph. It's not a lot, but it's enough for my ego. Mm-hmm. It's been plenty. So that's part of that dream come true, too. I've achieved that. And so that's pretty satisfying. Yeah.
When you met these idols, and these are people that I certainly like, Tim Conway, Christopher Guest, Chevy Chase, was there a little starstruck when you work with them? Was there a little like disappointment? They're not living up.
I was never disappointed. Chevy Chase is has a reputation as a crazy person.
Right, right. Jerk on the set.
And I think that he probably was and is to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I didn't let the artist take away from the art because I don't think there was anybody funnier when I was growing up. In the movies that he did when we were younger people.
Right.
I wanted to be that cool and funny, mm-hmm. as Ty Webb, mm-hmm. as Clark Griswold. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. It was a big deal. So I was intimidated to meet them, and they never disappointed me. He was actually gracious and kind of in my opinion, kind of a sad character. Mm-hmm. In the very short time that I spent with him. But it was
sad in what way? Just.
He shared sad stories about his life. I think that he has dealt with some, I don't know, perhaps some sort of depression, however it's come to him.
Well, I had read something where he had regretted leaving Saturday Night Live,
yeah.
You know, so I would imagine that plays into it as well.
Perhaps, and perhaps he's someone that wouldn't be satisfied with any success in his career. I don't know. I can't, I'm making things up here because I spent,
right.
3 days with the guy.
Right.
But he did tell me stories about being abused as a child and the struggle that he had with making the decision to go out too. He said, I didn't go out to L.A. for, like, with something in my pocket. I waited. I didn't work for a year when I went to L.A. As well. Mm-hmm. I went out for a girl. He said, everybody thinks I went out big for my britches. He had just done the roast, and he said it was heartbreaking. It crushed him because these people weren't his friends. They were paid by Comedy Central to be there and wreck him, and he left his sunglasses on because he was completely uncomfortable. It wasn't his friends giving him the business. And so I felt bad for the guy. I think that he might be, perhaps he's deserving of what people think of him, but that was my experience with him anyway.
And Christopher Guest has been known, I love his movies, mm-hmm. but he has a reputation of being a little aloof.
He's very aloof. He's a little aloof and distant, and he is not interested in breaking or joining you in any sort of
bits,
for sure. One of my biggest successes was I said in a funny way at the after party for the movie. I caught him at the table where they were serving food, and he was getting a little pasta, and I just asked him, "You having a little supper?" And for some reason, that tickled him, and he laughed, genuinely laughed. It was the only time I ever saw him laugh. So I scored. That was an accomplishment.
Your approach to the work when you get cast in something is to go and do the job, right? Do what the director asks.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I don't have any. I don't think that I know. I do think that I know better. I get disappointed sometimes in regards to, and I have had too many cooks in the kitchen. I've been told by a producer to do something and director to do something completely different. And it's a struggle, and that's fairly common, I think, in the business. But my immediate boss is who I'm going to appease. I'm going to do what I'm told to do, at least attempt it. And I think that's the job of a professional actor, certainly in television and film. And because you don't flesh it out. You don't go to rehearsals and figure it all out together. You know, it's a machine, and especially in like sitcom world and stuff like that. So you just do what you're told. You'd be able to hit. That's why you get the job to begin with. You know, you went into the audition, and they don't have to work with you so much. You nailed it. So they don't have to give you a lot of notes. They don't have to work on you. They've got too many other things to do. You come in and do your job, and you go. And I like that. I miss the romance of theater. I miss the rehearsal very much, and I miss doing shows that way. But I like it as a job, and I'd love to work enough where I continue to think of it that way.
Now, I'm also hearing a lot that there's more, you know, with the Judd Apatows and the Christopher Guest and Larry David, there's more improvisation. In the auditions, there's more improvisation when you do movies. There's more improvisation when you do certain TV shows. Are you finding that to be the case since you've been out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it might be a bit fatty. Meaning it's a fad because those movies are popular and those guys are very funny. And people want to see those movies, the Judd Apatow movies, where Will Ferrell's riffing. That's what people want to see for comedy. I, coming from a different generation, as much as I love improvisation, don't appreciate it as much in film.
what do you mean by that? That you think
I respect for the writer. Of the script, and I think it's fun to try to accomplish the writer's intention. I think that that's a lot of fun for me to figure out that beat, that exact intention that he had, and hit that moment that they have so carefully planned in their head and on the paper. I think that that is a talent and a skill to really not only acquire but to hone. If somebody is working in comedy, as opposed to you're a funny guy. I find that those movies that rely so heavily on that are that, and I find them thin in story and lacking in as a whole package. You go to see the funny bits as opposed to enjoy the entire movie as a film, as a piece of art. And you know, Albert Brooks, on the other hand, and Woody Allen and even the Marx Brothers and people like that. That was all tightly, carefully figured out things that worked, and they hit it. And I like doing that. Maybe it's my theater background. I like the rehearsal and figuring those things out. I think improv has a great place for, like at Second City, they teach it as a writing tool, and I love that. And I love it when it works, and I love it to be loose as an actor and connect with another actor. I think it has, of course, it has a place and it's a necessary skill or a good skill to have in your handbag, your actor's. But just in my own personal preference, I prefer the scripted stuff.
Great. We've got to wrap this up. Two questions before we wrap this up. One is, what's next for you? What would you like to do? If you could have anything.
I'd have 4 seasons on a TV show.
Why 4 seasons?
Because after 3 seasons, you re-up.
Meaning
your contract change. When you sign a contract for a pilot for a network television show, which I've done a number of times, and it's never gone, except for the comeback. When you sign that contract, they own you for 3 years at that rate that you've been hired for. And if the show is a success, that contract gets renegotiated after that 3-year time is up. And if they want to keep Jerry Seinfeld for season 4 because it's gotten huge, then they got to pay him a lot more money to keep him on. You know, and that's how televisions work. So people that go many, many seasons, that's why Friends were making so much money at the end, because they could easily walk away, and they could demand that much more money to stay on the air and make that company billions of dollars. So if I could be a little part of that where I'm on a television series that maybe I have a family. I'm interested in making money in the business now. Like we talked about before, I've accomplished some dreams come true. So now I'm interested in making some money for the future of me and my kids in this career, and that would be the way to do it, I think.
So you've gotten a lot of pilots then in the past where, you know, it's like, okay, if you make, you know, if you...
It's sickening. It's nauseating because you sign this paper that has this amount of money, and if they go to 13, I'm going to make that 13 times this year. I'm going to make, you know,
And it's anywhere from 30 to,
it's where your quote, it goes up every time you do a new pilot. And if you do a new pilot, they negotiate for you to get at least a little bit more than the last one that you signed on for, regardless of what happened with that show. If it was dead in the water, it doesn't matter. You sign on for this, now you're getting to go up a little bit. And I've raised my quote to something that is really desirable for me to have. So if I landed a show, I would make a good deal of money if it continued for a number of seasons.
And the funny thing is, don't you sign the contract? Like,
you sign it.
And right before you go
to audition.
So how do you like look at something and you're like, okay, now I could make $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 an episode, whatever that figure is, for 13, you know, I'll be set. You know, even if it was a year, I'd be in good shape. How do you go in that room?
You have a talent that I don't have, because I think that has spooked me more than anything else. I look at those numbers and then I get greedy and have that desire and my head's out of it, and I go in and that is a factor that I shouldn't be considering. I should just be doing my best job in there.
Is it you want the job?
I want the job. I want the job.
So what is
that money?
How does your performance change then? Is it more aggressive? Is it, do you try harder?
I think I maybe try harder. I've considered all these wonderful possibilities. If I get this job and the stakes are higher, all of a sudden in my brain, and I'm just more nervous.
And
it means a lot. It would literally change your life. If you got the show and it went on even a season, it would be somewhat financially life-changing.
So with the comeback with Pauly G, was the figure so low you were just like, HBO. It's like a commercial, basically. You know?
That might have been a factor. Right. The second the thing that was about HBO was that it was HBO.
Mm-hmm.
That was intimidating enough. But I had very little to do in the audition process. It worked for me. The character worked for me. He didn't have very many lines even in the audition. It was just, I was able to glare at her and I nailed it, I guess. So.
And then one last question. And this is, what would you give to somebody who's starting out in improv today?
In improvisation, I would say do it as much as you can. I would say anybody in the business that's in this business, do as much as you can in any regard, aspect of like we talked about earlier. You can work I worked in the box office, you know, do anything you can to be involved in that community. Get that experience, because experience is the best teacher.
Lance Barber, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you, Jimmy Craig.
Oh my God, this is great.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I loved Lance talking about turning down the Second City Touring Company to move to Los Angeles. I'd like to thank Stage 773 here in Chicago, who allowed us to record this episode there. Also, my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. Without Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, all you need to do is go to my slick new website at jimmycorain.com. Also, we are taking over social media, and we're doing it very subtly. First with Facebook, go to Improv Nerd and like our Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Then follow us at improv_nerd, and then our wonderful YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast. And Dan Schiffmacher has put so much time and energy into this. You'll see little clips from our actual show, video clips. Also, we are lucky enough to be a part of and be included in feralaudio.com. It's a podcast collective. Go check it out. There's people like Chelsea Peretti and Dan Harmon and Todd Barry and Matt Dwyer and Steve Agee. They all have podcasts. They're some of the most innovative and hilarious podcasts out there. So check that out, feralaudio.com. I want to thank our sponsors today, Bughouse Theater in Chicago. For more information, go to bughousetheater.com or email them at bughouse@bughousetheater.com. Also, check out Ben Noble's new book, Improv ABC, The A to Z Guide to Becoming an Unstoppable Improviser. All you need to do is go to improvabc.com. That's improvabc.com. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk. Don't run. He's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Hello. I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. And he's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My